right. Welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again. It is the Dom and Colin podcast. Back to break down episode 13 of Survivor Island of the Idols. I am Colin alongside Dom. Dom, how you doing this week?
Well, I've been better, and Survivor has definitely been better, but I at least am soldering on. I don't know if we can say the same for the show just yet.
Yeah, we will find out very soon, actually, on Wednesday night, as this is all finally coming to a close. We are getting very close to that finale, recording this on Monday, hopefully going to have this up by Tuesday morning for everyone who is even interested in listening to Survivor podcasts at this point. But I would get it if people wanted to skip this one anyway, but while we're here, a lot to be getting into from this last week. And Dom, as I was getting ready for this podcast, I thought it was a pretty apt metaphor that I came out into my living room and my microphone stand was broken. Like, my mic was just hanging down from the USB wire, completely fallen off of the arm from which it generally hangs. And it turns out this piece of plastic in the whatever it's been 4 or 5 days since the last time we've podcasted together has, after years of being totally sturdy, just collapsed. And my microphone for today's episode, much like my spirit for podcasting about this season, is literally hanging on by a thread. So hopefully we can make it through.
Yeah, a perfect transition there. And you're not a superstitious person, so you didn't see that as an omen or portentous or really indicative of anything at all. It's just not a sign from the gods. It's really nothing to write home about.
I have been spending the last 8 years ignoring all of the warning signs that I should stop podcasting. So this was nothing new for me. But let's get into it, Dom. I'll a few things to get into in terms of plot points this week, but I think it would be pretty irresponsible not to start at the end of this episode, where we see, after a pretty formulaic Elaine boot that we will definitely talk through later on in the podcast, there is about 5 minutes of extra time, and I was really curious about what was going on here. I thought it was potentially going to be Boston Rob and Sandra are finally going to be revealed to the rest of the people, and whatever the next phase in that is going to be kicked off. But what we saw instead is Jeff Probst walks around the corner into camp, and we get the news that Dan has been pulled from the game. I believe, right? A survivor first, that someone has been taken out against their will. Is that accurate?
Yeah, you can question how much of sound mind someone like Brendan Hans was at the time, but the examples are few and far between, and as we said, this is one that is just definitively clear-cut. Dan was removed for disciplinary issues. Like, his conduct was poor enough that they saw fit to pull him, and there were no other circumstances going into this. It is what it says on the tin here.
Right, and so a card comes up at the end saying there was another incident that had happened off camera involving Dan and someone who was not a contestant in the game. The logical assumption, I think, is that it was some sort of crew member. Not many details have really surfaced to this point, and I'm not sure, frankly, how much we're ever going to find out about what really went down here. I would imagine there are a lot of legal technicalities that have been involved from the moment this became an issue on Survivor and are still persisting to this day. And that will probably dictate a lot of what we ever end up getting to hear about this. But Dom, I am sure that years from now, when we look back on Island of the Idols, this is what people are going to remember about it. And it's understandable and hard for that not to be the case. And I think I probably feel like that should be the case. Like, this is something that is such a big deal. It would be, a game of Survivor is so trivial compared to an issue of this magnitude. I will save the community references for another time because this is a serious podcast right now. But I am curious what you think about not only the impact it's had, obviously, on this season, but the impact on Survivor going forward. How do you feel like this issue that we've gone through all season long now with Dan and the way that it has ultimately played out is going to affect this franchise in the future?
So, I agree with you, first of all, that this is something that will be larger than just the blot that it leaves on this one season. And it is what the season will be remembered for. And it's hard for it not to be when, even if you had some amazing character or some amazing gameplay or whatever the usual metric is for honing a season in high esteem, it would be hard to square that up with something that just transcends the game as it is because of inaction by production that led to this growing and growing out of control. It would be tough to have much confidence in production as a whole for many reasons on many fronts going into the season anyway. I know that your confidence in them has certainly been at a low and was showing no signs of being restored. And I think as a whole, the fan base is a lot more cynical than they were in the past. There's always been the corner of the internet that just takes nothing about the show for granted or at face value and is always willing to question everything. And increasingly, that is looking more and more like the right attitude to take. And it's sad that we're in that state of affairs. But usually that has been confined to things happening within the game. It's the very convenient placement of idols or advantages or whatever your particular bugbear is in that direction. Whereas now it's also coming into stuff that goes beyond the game. It's the personal and ethical conduct of contestants and how the crew and production at large displays their own ethical conduct in reacting to that. And that's not going to be, that's not going to stop with any one season ending, right? It's not like there was one thing that happened this season. We get that wrapped up with a nice little bow on it and we kick it into touch and it's never seen again. And it seemed like that was almost what was happening over the past few weeks, where we have a string of episodes which are meant to speak to larger social themes, culminating in the one big episode with Dan. And then it felt like Dan was almost just like another Survivor contestant again, at least the way that the show presented him, the way that we saw his other contestants still in the game treat him. And then suddenly for this to flare up again in the biggest possible way only highlights everything that we were saying previously about just how lacking their response to it was in real time.
Right. I have certainly had a lot of complaints about many various forms of production decision making over the years, and it is really not only disappointing but almost kind of like terrifying that now I have to be worried in yet another regard going forward in terms of like player safety and just their respect for the people playing the game as human beings. And I actually want to flag up something that Andy Dennert wrote. Andy Dennert, normally of Reality Blurred, but this actually was written for Vulture.com, an article I believe titled how could Survivor have screwed this up so badly, and the pieces that I have highlighted are essentially along that theme, so that is, let's go with that as the working title. That was not worded so poorly, but it was something of that nature. But I want to read quickly from what Andy wrote, because I think he completely nailed it. And this apart from the obvious like human issues and everything wrong with how they handled Kelly's complaints and so forth, I feel like this is another huge problem that I would take with how all of this was handled by Jeff and everyone else on production. So to now read from Andy Dennert, once again over at Vulture.com, how could Survivor have screwed this up this badly? The answer may be in something that happened 10 years ago when Jeff Probst tried to quit Survivor. As he told the New York Times, quote, "My Achilles heel for a lot of my life was that nobody saw me as a storyteller, that they saw me as a white guy with dark hair who was just a game show host, and that, in terms of my own self-image, was the thing that could gut me," end quote. Survivor fans, TV critics, and the Television Academy saw Probst as one of reality TV's best hosts, but that wasn't enough. He became showrunner, and now his ego is in control, prioritizing being a, quote, storyteller above all else, and that's directly affected the people who make the show possible, its cast and crew. The way Probst has repeatedly framed what happened this season illustrates his priority. Story first, with real people whose real lives are affected as stand-ins for big themes. And now that is the conclusion of me reading from Andy. I think he totally hit the nail on the head there. And what I really object to is the way that Jeff, right around merge time, as Andy flags up again, and actually I have this quote written down too. When Survivor had that double merge episode, Jeff was describing it in the moment, knowing how it played out, as, quote, one of Survivor's most compelling and socially relevant seasons of all time. Tonight, the entire 2 hours centered around the seismic shift that is taking place in our culture regarding how men and women relate to and respect each other. This is not unique to Survivor. Survivor is just a microcosm for our real world. Situations just like this one are playing out in our offices and bars and our colleges across the country and the world. End quote. And I think that is a major issue for me, is them seemingly, I'm not going to say like reveling in the idea of being able to use these people as like stand-ins for their big themes of the season, but it definitely seems like they were fine with that when the opportunity presented itself.
Definitely. And I think there's an important distinction to draw, first of all, between the show being a medium for telling stories and being not actually an ideal or anywhere close to an ideal platform for that, because trying to muddy the waters there with the mechanics of a game show and everything that comes with that is only going to obscure the message a lot of the time. This can't be the Jeff Probst show, right? This can't be the revival of that, no matter how much he wants it to be, just because there is so much else going on. But I think at its best, and certainly in the past, Survivor has often been and can be a good way of transmitting those messages and having good representatives for groups that don't get too much exposure to either tell their stories or interact and create new stories. And that's one of the things that has always attracted me about it. Having said that, though, there's a difference between that and this is the story we want to tell, and therefore we are going to warp everything around that so that we tell that story, compared to this is a story that happened organically, and the fact that these stories can happen organically on our platform is what makes that appealing, and therefore we're going to show that, even if we have to drop some of our own assumptions and our own priorities in order to do that. And I think it's very clear which of those the show is leading towards at this point.
Right, and I think that second one is what makes Survivor so great. Door number two there, of these incredible stories and journeys unfolding that the world would never otherwise get to see anything close to, because of the unique format Survivor offers, is amazing when it actually goes that way, which it does all the time. But it seems like Jeff and everyone else is now of the opinion that it more or less must go that way every single time. And that is the set of priorities that is exactly the same set of priorities we were objecting to when it was handing Ben or Rick Devons idol after idol after idol, because their stories are better. And that's the story we want to tell here, is this person being the hero. It has not only now impacted Survivor the game, which for my money is what keeps people tuning in season after season. The game just works, and as long as the casting is not actively atrocious. And I feel like this continues to just seep further and further into every angle of Survivor, not only as a game, but now as a TV product as well. I think it's without a doubt their number one priority is making sure the story, and particularly like the big hero story, is something they can rely on all season long.
Yeah, I think there is a larger anxiety and confusion here among production, and maybe Jeff himself as well, about just what the show itself has to do in these circumstances. So I'm sure they loved getting the pats on the back and the virtual GLAAD awards that they're going to be carting around BoJack Horseman style for the Zeke and Varna incident. But at least in that case, Jeff himself was able to be this independent arbiter who also transcended his usual role as host who's telling people, you know, which order they can pick up puzzle pieces in. He was able to be this conduit for a larger national discussion. When the show itself has to take a moral stance on an issue, I don't think that's anywhere near as easy for them, and obviously it's never going to be. So you wonder, like, going back to the Zeke and Varna case, for instance, what would happen if there had been a movement to have Jeff eject, to have Jeff Varna ejected for his behavior in that case, like how the show would have responded, whether they would have tried to maintain that sense of objectivity or taken action themselves, and in doing so, implicitly or explicitly taking a stance on that.
I'm sure Tucker Carlson would have had a lot to say about the snowflakes over at Survivor,
oh, I bet,
throwing
yeah.
this guy out for free speech.
Oh, I bet he would have a lot to say about this season too if it was anywhere on his radar. But so in this case, they seem torn over whether they see themselves as this neutral incubator for action, where they just create this platform, things happen on that platform, and then if a boundary is crossed somewhere eventually, hypothetically, maybe they would have to step in and do something about it at long last. Or if they see themselves as active kind of custodians, if you like, where given that this is their platform, they get to clearly delineate what gets to happen on it. And if anyone even comes close to crossing that boundary, then they get one warning. And if it happens again, they're gone. And we know that Dan and the entire cast received several warnings that were not anywhere near as explicit as they should have been. And they seem to think that that was hopefully the end of the issue, when quite clearly it wasn't. And what is and also disturbing about this too is that it's encouraging the thought that Dan doing whatever it is that he did, and we're never going to know this, and it's not really something that we have a right to know, but it also would be useful to know to have any kind of informed stance on this, on what happened here. We don't know if they're taking a different line here, and this is what finally broke the camel's back, because it was a crew member, it was one of their own, someone involved in production, versus a contestant in the game who is seen to have like a different status in terms of what they signed up for, and so on and so forth.
I would be of the opinion that if this had happened to someone in the game, it would have been just as severe. But obviously, as you're saying, we cannot know really for sure.
Well, yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, not only do we not know what it is, if we did know, it would then invite comparisons versus just what the severity of that was compared to the stuff that he, quote unquote, got away with in the past, and where the line actually is. And none of that would really even be productive, I think. But either way, like, you do have to wonder, what is it that made them finally decide that a line had been crossed, and how much of that is one of their own being involved and that driving the conversation instead?
I obviously don't know. And it may be the case that they weren't taking it as seriously until it happened to someone on the crew. But alternatively, and I'm certainly not trying to like make excuses for Dan here, but I also wouldn't be that shocked if they were at the point where they were worried about Dan becoming too big of a character on the season and like making it to the finals or whatever, and they were looking for a reason potentially, and this happened to be the time that they essentially said, we can't run the risk of him going any further.
It's almost as if once they decide for the first time that his conduct is allowing him to stay in the game, it's tough for them to reverse that decision later on without losing face, unless another step has been taken. Some new incident has occurred that gives them new or further cause. And so, yeah, maybe they decided in retrospect, we really fucked up with how the Kelly accusations were handled and our response to those at the time. But now that we have some new, not new evidence, because the evidence was right there, they had it all on camera, because of course they do, but some new data, if you want to call it that, so, some new stuff to work with, that finally was the impetus for getting him out. Whereas otherwise they would have been like, well, do we now get some kind of delayed response where it's not, you know, it's not perfect and it's not timely, but maybe it's still correct of taking him out a week later? Or do we just sit on our hands, let him get to the finals, let him get zero votes? Although honestly, I'm not as convinced as I want to be that that's what he would have received. And just try and wipe our hands clean and hope that people ignore it afterwards.
I actually think I hadn't considered this until we started floating these hypotheticals, but it may be the case that the like best outcome in terms of how this actually went down for CBS is that they are lying about this second incident with Dan, and they did just come to their senses or decide for whatever reason that we have to pull this guy. And
yeah, it's almost like if they lied in order to make up a reason to reject him, it's like, well, okay, fair play, I guess. Like, I mean, it's still shady as fuck, but I mean, I'm glad you're finally doing something, even if this is what you have to go to justify it.
It seems vastly preferable to having another actual incident go down and having, you know, yet another instance of, like, should have seen that one coming as things pertain to Dan under their belt there. I am rooting for it being the case. I think that this second, or not even second, but, you know, this final situation was completely made up. I hope we find out that CBS just decided we have to get this guy out of here.
Yeah, and we're never going to know, so it's kind of fruitless to speculate, but it is just, you know, everything we said in the past about the way that Dan's edit has been handled this season, the way they responded to these incidents in real time and so on, takes on an entirely different character now that we know that he was in fact rejected after the fact. Like, that paints their inaction in the past in a whole different light to me.
Right, and that it certainly paints, as I quoted earlier from Andy Dennard on Vulture, those comments Probst was making around the merge are really almost like sickening to me now. The way he's talking about that being this great illustration of society at large, and actually, to bring one final quote in from the article, Andy really well summarized the exact thought I had, which is, to quote from one more time, he says, quote, "It's almost as if Survivor, CBS, and MGM Television set out to make a point about how institutions and people in power fail when dealing with charges of misconduct," end quote. That was certainly a thought that crossed my mind, is it's almost like they're trying to make the point that we're messing this up to illustrate how everyone messes it up, and now you've learned.
Well, I was looking at that from a different angle. I was thinking, so they seemed very pleased with themselves over the way that they showcase, like, the Jamal and Jack discussion, for instance, or some of the other adjacent issues that have come up on the show this season. And maybe they're proud of themselves, too, for the way they handled the Dan thing, you know, right? We're inviting this larger conversation, and we, as the sensible grown-ups in the room, handled all of this responsibly, and now we're showing you as an example of how this can and should be done. And that's almost the more worrying scenario to me.
Yes.
Which is that, you know, because you could see, knowing that on this season, which is going to end effectively in Dan being ejected for misconduct, we are going to have as little discussion of larger social topics as humanly possible. We're going to focus entirely on the game and the characters and so on. And when this finally happens, we're just going to say, Dan was ejected for misconduct. That's a title card, leave it at that, move on, answer and invite no further questions. But, and that would be a cover-up of sorts, but it would be understandable in the sense of, like, well, we don't want to tie this into anything larger. We don't want to paint this season as where these hot topics are being discussed in a mature and open way, and then raise people's expectations so high, and then have them just plummet to the ground and shatter with the way they handle this, which only makes me think that they're actually, you know, they're perfectly okay with how they handle the situation, and that's a scary thought.
So this also made the New York Times, the failing New York Times, Dom, Survivor made headlines there as well, and unfortunately I don't have the author of that article handy, but the conclusion they came to was that it might be wise for Jeff and the Survivor franchise in general on finale night to potentially apologize for some of the ways that they handled various things over the course of this season and explain what they probably could have or should have done differently. And maybe it is the case, as you were laying out, and it would certainly be the worst case, as far as I'm concerned, that they are actually really thrilled with how they handled this, and they think they did a great job. I am more of the failing New York Times opinion that it would be quite useful for Jeff to show up on Wednesday night and lay out, you know, hey, we had this go down. This was obviously new to us and is a major issue in all sorts of ways all over the world. And here is what we have learned from this. And if we had it all to do over again, this is what we would do differently. And if you need any assistance with any of this, here are some resources for where you can go to find out more. But we do know Dan will not be at the reunion, and it will also be taped for the first time since season one, several hours ahead of time, instead of airing live after the finale. Dom, what do you not hope for, but what do you expect the CBS line to be on reunion night in terms of will they be satisfied with how they've handled it, or do you see Jeff making some sort of amends and saying we could have done better?
I don't think Jeff is going to admit any kind of fault publicly. I think what they'll do is hopefully invite Kelly to say her piece on the topic, and any of the other cast members who wish to contribute to that, put up a card with some resources on it. Jeff will have some kind of official statement to make in that capacity, but I don't see them trying to atone for their own handling of the situation at all. I've seen a lot of criticism of them for pre-taping the finale, and while it does allow them to control the narrative in terms of editing things before it's released and so on and so forth, to me that's kind of the point, right? It's if that conversation takes a turn that would just not be healthy or productive for it to be aired on national TV under these circumstances, then you can also get ahead of that and stop that from being a problem, right? So for as much as it does give them an opportunity to sweep it under the rug again, or to I understand why people don't trust them to make use of that power, if you like.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how else you could really do it, right? Like, Dan is not going to be there, but you know, if someone else in the cast has an unhealthy response to the situation, let's say, then you want to be able to control for that, even if you don't control it itself.
Yeah, I, on one hand, am excited about the prospect of, hey, the reunion's taping early. They may give them a bit of a longer leash in terms of letting them talk a bit longer or explore some tangents that they may not have necessarily wanted to get into when they know they're so up against the clock on a live broadcast. And maybe that will be great for the reunion, and they'll piece together all the best stuff, and it'll be awesome. However, I just don't know how I can look myself in the mirror in good conscience and say, yeah, I have faith in these producers to do that. I feel like the smart thing to have the faith in these producers to do is mess it up at this point.
Yeah, and I know that this podcast in particular has been a recurring source of complaints about the reunion show and making fun of it and so forth. But honestly, I would take Jeff talking to some random small child in the audience, or you know, the second cousin's army instructor of one of the pre-match contestants or something. As long as we just don't miss the elephant in the room in the worst possible fashion, I'll take it. You know, I'm setting the bar real low here.
To quickly sidebar off of Dan, and maybe permanently sidebar off of Dan, because I don't have a ton more to add at this point, but call your shot, Dom. Will we see the return of the little kid in the audience correctly voting for the winner?
I have to think so, yeah. And even that small child will correctly discern that it's probably going to be Tommy, yes?
Yeah, I would guess Tommy would be the main rooting interest of America's youth, at least by the end of the finale when the votes are being revealed. But I did find it so funny that they didn't do it for 38, because they would not be able to find a small child in the room or in the world who was rooting for Chris to come off the edge of extinction and go on to win.
Put it this way, if a small child says anyone other than Tommy, I'm calling the FCC. I want a full investigation.
Yeah, all right. So that will, I hope, do it for Dan in the Survivor conversation, at least for this week. I'm sure, you know, after we see the finale next week and talk about the season as a whole, this will come up. But let's get into the other things we saw play out this week and take a quick preview at that finale that is right around the corner. Dom, let's get into this edition of Island of the Idols, which seems like it's going to be the final edition of Island of the Idols, at least in its current form. It does appear that in the finale, everyone's going to take a trip there and get the big reveal that Rob and Sandra have been there all along. And I guess it's only going to be a surprise to Tommy, which is pretty good. But let's get into Dean's trip here to Island of the Idols. And I want to start first with how Dean got to go to Island of the Idols, which is the guy in the boat shows up and hands him a bag, and it says, quote, "Sometimes it comes down to chance. Draw one name from the bag." And then there was a series of confessionals seeming to strongly imply that everyone had a 1 in 7 chance of going. I know I am not alone in believing that that is obviously not true, right? That, of course, it was, I don't even think 3 names in the bag. We have Dean, Dan and Tommy who have not been, I would speculate it was only Dean and Tommy in the bag. I do not believe they would give Dan an opportunity to have a segment of his own and a chance at a huge advantage going to the end. I would say they would absolutely go so far as to have only Dean and Tommy's names in this bag. Where do you land on that, Dom?
It is exactly as credible as Jeff saying, well, you've won immunity. You now have a 1-in-6 shot of winning the game or whatever. Like, we know that's a bit of a fuzzy math, and this is definitely some fuzzy math too.
So as it was happening, I was fully prepared to be proven wrong, because I've been saying since before we even saw this play out, they will never open the door for someone to go back twice, because what they want is the big surprise as they walk around the corner and suddenly Rob and Sandra are there. And I was so prepared in the moment to be made a fool of and see Janet's name get pulled out of the bag. But then once Dean's name did get pulled out of the bag, I became confident that there was never any other scenario besides potentially Tommy.
Let me follow up on that then. Do you think they would have preferred Tommy to go, or does Dean going work out the way they want it to?
I really don't know. I asked myself that question, but couldn't come up with anything conclusive in either direction. Do you have a take? Because I do think it would be funny, as seems quite likely at this hour, if the season that is themed around Rob and Sandra giving lessons to all these new Survivor players is essentially amounts to a massive net negative on the people who visit Island of the Idols, and the one person who never goes ends up winning the game, as I think is possible. So with that in mind, if they felt like Tommy was a huge favorite in the moment, they may have wanted him to go so he could at least get that obligatory lesson. But do you have a strong take either direction?
Yeah, if you think, as everyone else seemed to think, that Tommy is the overwhelming favorite, surely you want him to go, preferably in the final Island of the Idols visit of the season, to receive that final pep talk, validation, lesson, and all of that combined.
And advantage.
Of course, Colin, of course. Not that he's going to need it, probably, but you want him to get all of that and more. And it would be so weird as well if, with Rob and Sandra being like the voices of the chorus here, like they speak for the audience, they represent the standards of what good gameplay is, for them to have never met Tommy and then possibly, who knows, be asked to have their own input on the winner would be a little jarring. So yeah, it would be strange for him to just never meet them and then ended up for them to join his eventual coronation.
I mean, especially after they spend all season talking about how Survivor is about making huge moves and playing advantages to your benefit and impressing the jury, to be the one guy who never has any advantages and doesn't do anything particularly flashy.
It's like somehow in the modern era of Survivor, Tommy would be the one person to never have to play an idol or an advantage and to win by playing this incredibly old school, almost just social game, right? Where he's just staying out of trouble and letting other people disintegrate.
So I agree with that, and with that in mind, just remembering this time last season, how we spent the entire penultimate podcast talking about it, and I believe even doing like a bunch of season 40 content, speaking in terms like Rick Devens is just the winner of season 38, and it's just a foregone conclusion. So let me just get your take on this. I don't think there's, I think we generally don't do an edit zone for the penultimate episode. We just talk freely when there's so little time left. Let me ask you, is it a completely done deal in your mind that it has to be Tommy? Because at least part of me is still leaving the door open. And I will again acknowledge it is largely because of that comment about Rob and Sandra talking about what a foregone conclusion it is that a woman's going to win.
I think it could be Lauren. I think it could be Janet. But I say that mainly because I don't think Tommy's edit is objectively that good. Like, we've had winners in the past. Like, we covered Fiji for our patron rewatch, where I know that you said, yeah, man was in the mix. And in retrospect, I agree with you. But it was always going to be one of the two of them, right? Like, if you ask someone after episode two, it's like, yeah, it's Earl or Yao Man. And the only question is, how are their edits going to interact over time? With this, it's always been, well, Tommy is the best of a bad bunch, but it's never, oh my God, Tommy is the overwhelming favorite. How could anyone else possibly be in with a chance? It's just, someone has to be at the top by default, so mathematically, so it may as well be him.
Yeah, it is pretty overwhelming, I would say, how the consensus is all on Tommy, but I get it. When episode after episode, he comes in looking the way he does. But at the same time, I feel like if Janet in particular were to win, would it look that much different than this? And maybe Tommy is the big dragon that she slays in fire making at Final Four, because I am at least open to the possibility that Lauren could leave at Final Five.
I'm open to that too. I think Janet winning at fire and then losing is certainly in play as well. I wish I could say that she's definitely getting as much respect from the jury as she's getting from basically the entire audience at this stage.
Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, I've gotten the sense that everyone seems to like and respect Janet quite a bit, but it probably depends on how the end game plays out and who she is up against, because recency bias seems to go a long way with jurors on day 39. But we'll talk more about big picture stuff later on. Let's not lose too much focus on Island of the Idols here, because there were a couple quotes from Boston Rob here this week that I thought were pretty funny. One was when Dean gets there and tries to validate his fake legacy advantage, and job well done by Sandra and Rob playing that one cool. But Dean explains his plan of, I'm at least considering the idea of trying to get everyone to vote for me at Final Six, and then I'll bust out this legacy advantage and be safe. And obviously Rob knows, and we all know, that that would be a disaster for Dean because this is fake. But if Dean does think it's real, and in Boston Rob's quote here, he says, quote, Dean, it's never a good idea to get the votes put onto yourself, even with a real legacy advantage, end quote. And I actually disagree with that. I think if it was real, I think it'd be a very good idea. And especially when you're giving him literally the lesson in jury management and making these huge spectacle moves, like to be mocking this guy for what I think is actually pretty forward-thinking stuff. And to go back to it from earlier, I know, again, this looks stupid because it was fake, but Dean making that move at Final Nine with the fake advantage and trying to get that target off of him, it's not going to matter because he's not going to have a chance to do anything at Final Six, as it turns out anyway. But I think in both of these cases, Boston Rob and the general Survivor public are like massively shortchanging Dean here.
Yeah, Dean's the one who really got screwed over by this whole debacle, if you think about it. But it's always been weird to me when Rob is held up as this genius of Survivor strategy, when you listen to his public statements on it, when he has a chance to use that platform for whatever he wants, like on IOJP or anywhere else.
This podcast all the time, Dom, friend of the podcast, Boston Rob.
Yeah, he's a friend of a friend, right? Like, he and Daniel Negreanu were good buds, so just by extension. But yeah, you would understand if he's giving, he knows that for the cameras on Island of the Idols, he needs to give some soundbite friendly wisdom, which maybe is a little shallow when you dig deeper into it. But when he's able to go long form, like on IOJP or elsewhere, it's really not that much more developed, honestly. There's no real pearls of wisdom buried in there, and yet people treat it like he's some kind of visionary, and I've never really quite got it, and this season isn't making me reconsider that yet.
I agree. I feel like in this case in particular, and in many of these cases, and maybe he's being told to do this, but like, this to me is Boston Rob just like totally shitting on what is, in my mind, a very good idea if this thing were actually real. And maybe he's just saying this off the top, you know, off the cuff, and doesn't really mean that much by it, and I get that they want him to be the big shark, but to be just so dismissive of plenty of what I've considered pretty good ideas. And further, in the other quote that I thought was hysterical from Boston Rob this week is another illustration of that. When he's explaining the lesson about jury management, he says, you know, this is something I didn't even realize till I was playing in Redemption Island. Like, this guy is the face of the franchise. He is widely regarded as the greatest player of all time, who openly did not think about jury management until he had 100 days of experience under his belt.
Bearing in mind that it is entirely possible to think about jury management having never watched the show before.
Yes.
There are many people out there who think entirely too much about jury management, spend a lot of their time wrestling with that concept. And here's someone who lost a jury vote to arguably the most bitter jury of all time up until that point, and somehow the idea of jury management just never entered his brain until 5 years later. Like, it's really baffling when you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't mean to tell Rob Cesternino what he should consider insightful Survivor commentary or just good content in general. And I'm sure anytime he has Boston Rob on the podcast, it is a huge deal, and rightfully so. But I was listening to some episode of RHAP this week, and he talked about Boston Rob being his number one person that he enjoys talking to, in terms of the guy just knows like every single element of Survivor in and out. And I've just never, I was shocked when I heard him say that. And I've never come away with anything close to that sort of take. But I certainly don't disagree that Rob is extremely effective at what he does and the way that he thinks about Survivor for himself. I just think it is a complete fool's errand to apply that to literally anyone else playing Survivor. I don't think anyone else is in the position to do anything close to what Rob does.
But part of the beauty of the show and what keeps it going after 39 seasons is that so many different play styles can be effective for the people that use them or who are priced into using them just because of their personality and their talents and so on and so forth. But Rob seems to be locked into this model of, well, this is how I won the game eventually, and so this is how everyone must win the game in order to be valid, or this is the most likely route for anyone to win the game, which is just clearly not true, as his partner on Island of the Idols could tell him, having come off her two wins, his one, lest we forget. This is especially weird given that Dean has survived in the game in part because Kelly set up this heist with him where he would get all the votes and he would play the idol to knock out Jack, and that's the one big thing that propelled him forward and ended up leading to her demise instead, in actual fact. So it's understandable why Dean would think this, even if it's not a great idea. And so, you know, at least Rob could maybe try to understand it from Dean's perspective, because that's the crucial skill of empathy that you need on Survivor. But instead, he's just going off on one in confessional, like he's having a moment.
He's yes-anding Dean the whole time and then just mocking him.
Well, no, he's like no-butting Dean instead. You know, it's like the exact opposite.
I guess so, yeah. I also liked that – I didn't like that it literally came down to a flip of a coin for Dean getting his choice of these advantages, but I thought it was so funny – how big the coin was. It was impossible to like flip in an easy and TV friendly manner, and they literally had to, like, you can see Rob flip it, and he does truly like put his hand down on top of it and he's able to get it down, but like on the shot where it's him just covering his hand as they're like drawing out suspense for which way it's going to have landed, you can clearly tell there's no coin underneath his hand in that shot, because it was so ugly and like protruded so much from his hand, because it was enormous. It looked like an ice cream sandwich underneath his between his hands.
I did love as well their attempt to frame this as Dean accepting this coin flip is a big move, and then everyone on Twitter, all the previous contestants who were involved in actual rock draws, chiming in to say there is zero chance I would ever consider that to be a move, let alone a big move, and just completely rebutting the premise of the episode.
I mean, I do want to give Rob credit for his salesmanship here in trying to pitch it as, oh man, you have a real chance to shake up your game if you accept this flip of a coin. That's a huge move, and you can really sell that to the jury. I thought he did a good job of at least selling it to the casuals a little bit, that this was a high stakes situation. So would you, I guess, briefly worth diving into, if you are Dean, are you definitely flipping the coin? Did any of the advantages stand out to you in particular?
None in particular, although I didn't think about it in great detail. I'm not sure that Dean thought about it in great detail. I think he just wanted to high roll. You know, I think he just wanted to flip a coin.
Yeah, and I would be inclined to flip the coin as well. I would not have been interested in the idol that I had to use on someone else, barring an extremely specific circumstance in the game, and I guess this is all happening before Dean knows he's going to win. He won the immunity, right?
I believe so.
I fast forwarded the challenge. I'm pretty sure Dean won the immunity. I believe the idol nullifier is probably his best bet. I think the other one was an extra vote that was probably only good through final five, so I don't see that being of a ton of value in Dean's spot. So idol nullifier seems good enough, but it is very nerve-wracking for me, Dom, the prospect that while I do believe Lauren could easily go at final five, it does seem like a lot of people have their sights set on Janet, and while she does pick up another idol here, it would certainly break my heart to watch her play the idol and have it get nullified and have this coin flip be a million-dollar swing against Janet's favor.
Yeah, this finale, when you think about it, could just be complete brutality from start to finish in terms of what it could be and what we're hoping for it to be versus what it surely inevitably is going to be.
Yeah, I am very much bracing myself for some disaster timelines here. But either way, a fitting conclusion, I would say, for the Island of the Idols, where it is just comically bad how out of ideas they are. And I'm sure Boston Rob was happier than anyone to be able to just drop the act and take a break before season 40.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all right. So I guess a quick note here on this immunity challenge. We have finally a word puzzle. This is our first immunity since we hit the individual phase that is not balance and endurance. And I believe I saw Miles Nye on Twitter, friend of the podcast, Miles Nye, big-time genius superfan. Miles Nye was the designer of this challenge, this word puzzle, where it was, whatever it was, 7 or 8 four-letter words that needed to be pieced together. And we'll go with Dean was the one who ended up winning it here. So big shout-out to Miles there for getting yet another challenge on Survivor and snapping that streak of balance and endurance. Although I guess, Miles, pro tip for you, buddy, start designing some balance and endurance challenges and you might have a better chance of getting more challenges on there.
Yeah, if you just want reliable work for the rest of your career, you know where your bread is buttered, Miles. Yeah. You know what you have to do.
That seems like the clear emergent game strategy or whatever. Dom, not a lot of suspense here as far as this vote is going to be concerned. Elaine gets what I would consider like kind of an all-time Survivor swan song here. How much of this do you think had to do with just their sheer love for Elaine, or how much do you think had to do with them knowing this is going to be a story that is buried in 5 minutes, so what's even the point of setting up any kind of suspense?
Yeah, buried in 5 minutes, and also once we get onto the thing that buries it, we want people to focus on literally anything else, please, if possible. So why not give this rousing send-off to Elaine while we still can and get people's spirits up before we drag them back to the ground again?
Mm-hmm. So as far as you are concerned, parting thoughts on Elaine 1.0. I'm guessing you're on board that Elaine will be back?
I don't know if I am, actually. I think it's easy for people's memories to fade fast, especially for the fan favorites who always burn bright, and then often we don't actually see them again. So the Lauren rumors of the world can attest to this, where they're the talk of the town for a while, and then you fast forward 2 seasons, and no one's talking about them anymore.
I liked Lauren Rimmer as much as anyone else. She was not getting the Elaine treatment as far as the CBS edit was concerned.
Sure, but I don't know if Elaine is so much more than that, that she's in an entirely different category. And then I also think that with season 40 coming down the pipeline and their desire to obliterate the season from the collective memory, I worry that, like, with season 40, that's going to reset the clock in terms of return appearances. And it's someone who was on Edge of Extinction, let's say, that's basically going to be ancient history by the time that 41 and 42 roll around.
It's certainly possible. I have, though, noticed some tweets from former survivors who may be in the mix if there were a hypothetical Survivor Second Chance.
Oh,
to...
it's that time of year again?
Like... It seems, I don't know, but it wouldn't blow me away if they were pretty quick to head back to the returnee bucket. in the not too distant future. I don't see it being as soon as 41, but I would not be at all surprised if 42 is a returnee season.
Spencer has emerged from his Nepalese monastery to go on some mushroom-fueled discourse on Twitter.
I wish. unfortunately not this time around, I would imagine, but you never know. So I would imagine that if that were to come into play, if there were a returnee season soon, Elaine would very much be in the mix. And while she did strike me as someone who was absolutely a ton of fun on this season of Survivor, was completely there to play and probably has learned a great deal about things she could do differently if given another opportunity, I do worry that Elaine, unless she has a lot of time pass between now and an eventual return appearance, may have been too kind of big of a darling to her first time around to be given a ton of rope the second time around. Something actually to return to another RHAP podcast that I was listening to this week, something he was talking about with Christian Hubicki, Dr. Christian Hubicki, about was the sense people can potentially get out there in a game of Survivor when you realize someone is like the Rick Devons kind of production darling. That can be a very bad thing to have working against you in an end game, in terms of how the other, it's certainly helpful when it comes to finding hidden immunity idols, but hurtful potentially in terms of people wanting to vote you out if the door is ever open for that sort of thing. And I can see Elaine potentially falling victim to that of everyone, just because she was so fun and such a big character her first time around, people potentially being even more afraid of Elaine than they necessarily should be as a returnee.
Yeah, and maybe her second cast will have more respect for the good name of Ronnie Bada and actually take heed of his warning and get her out of the game while they're still tied.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So there goes Elaine. We do have one other thing that I actually want to get to in terms of just mechanics before we get into the finale. Interestingly, because Dan is not on the jury, that should theoretically now throw off the numbers and potentially get in the way of Rob and Sandra potentially casting jury votes. But we have Jack now because we'd started a round earlier. So under certain conditions, we could easily now revert this back to just a normal jury that can easily crown Tommy, right?
So with Dan out of the picture, is what you're saying?
Right. With Dan now out of the picture, we return to the right number of jurors, I believe, right? Do we go down to nine? I can't do, I was told there would be no math, okay? I don't know why I brought this up.
It's all right. The end is in sight. It'll all be over soon. Don't worry about it.
I'm trying because I'm like, okay, we merged at 13, but Jack didn't make the merge, so minus one, and I'm not sure where I'm not carrying the right numbers. So I'm not sure what I think we are left with a 10-person jury now, right, which is the normal number?
I think so, if I'm following it correctly. But I imagine if there was a decision made to either put Rob and Sandra on the jury or lock them out of the jury, they're not going to suddenly reverse that now with just a handful of days left in the game just because of this one unforeseen incident.
Yeah, I mean, the reason you want to avoid a 12-person jury is to avoid any chance of a 4-4-4 tie. But when you, the producers, essentially control two of those votes, you can avoid that 100% of the time.
The tiebreaker is which juror has the highest finish in the previous season. All right, vote. Done.
Yeah. All right. And by the way, I know there haven't been many material changes in terms of why we should believe or not believe Rob and Sandra might vote. But when I saw Jack was going to be a juror, I was thinking to myself, okay, it is quite likely that Rob and Sandra are going to vote. I am now at the point where I'd be surprised if Rob and Sandra end up voting in the finale.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. I guess not a huge difference maker either way. Or at least as far as we know right now. Hopefully no more on that front in any future podcasts. But Dom, I guess let me ask you a couple of things in terms of just projections entering this finale. From Final Five forward, it seems to me like it's going to be one of Lauren or Janet leaving at Final Five, and that most people are quite nervous on Janet's behalf, counting on her idol getting nullified and just being viewed as too much of a jury threat. I am open to the possibility, because of a scene that was in this most recent episode, the one where Tommy is shown kind of enjoying lying to Lauren after assuring her, oh, no, 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 we definitely need to get rid of Janet. But, you know, behind her back, he's secretly rallying everyone to get rid of her instead. I feel like entering every finale, I just decide on something that has to be the case that is just totally wrong, such as the two that really stand out to me are Donathan has to lose in fire and right. Kyle Jason has to lose to Michelle in the finals. There's like Noah, there, it's going to be a final two and he's going to lose in the final two or something like that. I thought Kyle Jason had to be a losing finalist, and I'm nervous that me counting Janet is just gone at final five is going to be the thing that surprises me.
So what alternative fate do you see for her instead?
I could see losing at fire somehow, even though she seems quite proficient in that capacity, or God forbid losing finalist, or please, please, please winner, Dom. Why can't Janet win?
Why can't anyone win? Why are we counting anybody out?
Well, I think there is reason to be counting out the Noras, perhaps, or the Deans, perhaps.
How dare you?
But I do think it would be foolish to say either of Janet or Lauren is dunchained at this hour. I would say entering the finale, I would probably have Tommy at like 90% and Janet and Lauren both around 5%, although maybe, you know what I'm going to say? I'm going to give Janet 7% and Lauren 3%, because I really feel like a Janet win would make a lot more sense based on what we've seen of her to this point than a Lauren win would to me. I feel like we'd be seeing so much more of Lauren if she were to go on to win after being in the majority for so much of the game here. So I'm going to go Tommy 90, Janet 7, Lauren 3. Is that roughly the page you're on, or are you going higher? Where are you?
I'm sure I could quibble with the numbers, but that sounds about right. I'm not going to take you to task for that one.
Okay, so let me ask you, in terms of zero-vote finalist, always a fun discussion, how about over under, I think this would be a fun prop, over under total combined jury votes received by Dean and Nora. I will set the line. Initially, I was going to say 0.5. I will allow for, with this many jurors, one random vote. I will say over under the two of them combined, 1.5 jury votes.
I'm going to say under. I think exactly one might be the sweet spot.
Yeah, I would definitely take the over on 0.5, just because there is always a chance of that one random Ralph Kaiser vote for Philip Shepard. But over 1.5 may be pushing it if Tommy or Janet or Lauren is the person that they are facing. And I guess it's got to be one of them in at least one of them in the finals. But you know what? For the sake of it being a zero stake wager, I will take the over and just hopefully score another point on you on the all-time argument board that someone is closely tracking, I'm sure. Dom, any other thoughts on this episode or calls you want to make before the finale?
I'm good. I really have, you know, I the finish line is in sight now. I just want to stagger over it, and I want to be done with the season. I want to get out of here.
Okay. I am pretty much on board with that as well. We will be back to break down the finale, hopefully with some interesting points of discussion to get into beyond how the reunion is handled, but we will see how all of that goes. Thank you guys who have made it this far. I'm sure anyone listening to us talk this late into this particular season is quite a committed fan of the cause, so big fan of anyone who is hearing my voice right now. We are, of course, on Twitter. He is at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone. And we are underway with China on Patreon right now, which should be hopefully a more regular schedule now going forward, now that Dom is available again. You can sign up for that over at patreon.com/DomandColin, and actually a quick tease there coming soon. is going to be, after we see how this finale plays out, the return of my great friend in real life, Casual Anna, to give her thoughts from the casual perspective on this Survivor season and also the most recent season of The Challenge. So if you would like that sort of premium content, one more time, patreon.com/DomandColin. Enjoy the finale as best you can, guys. We will talk to you very soon. Take care, everybody.